Hi, I'm Brian McCreath, and this is The Answered Question from WCRB in Boston for March 3rd, 2017. This podcast is about creativity through music as expressed by the musicians you hear on the air each weekend on WCRB. This is a part of Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony, the Leningrad, as it was performed last Saturday night at the Boston Symphony Orchestra and conductor Andras Nelsons. It's been recorded for the third volume of Under Stalin's Shadow, the Deutsche Grammophon series that's now won 2 Grammy Awards in a row. I'm not sure when that recording will be released, but you can hear this performance right now at our website, classicalwcrb.org. Unfortunately, the other piece on the program, Sofia Gubaidulina's Triple Concerto, is not available on demand because of restrictions imposed by the publisher. But you can hear that piece again next Monday night, March 6th at 8 p.m. And in case you missed it on last week's podcast, you can hear a conversation with all 3 of the soloists in Gubaidulina's piece. Also on demand at the website is WCRB in concert with the Chameleon Arts Ensemble and Trio con Brio Copenhagen, both of whom were featured last Sunday night. Again, it's all at classicalwcrb.org. This week, the Boston Symphony is out of town playing concerts in Montreal and Toronto over the weekend, following a few concerts they just played at Carnegie Hall. So, on tomorrow night's BSO broadcast, you'll hear 2 Brahms symphonies that were performed earlier this season, but were never on the radio. Because of the scheduling of the 2-week Brahms deep dive the BSO did last November, the 1st and 3rd symphonies weren't on Saturdays. So, now you'll hear them on this Saturday, as well as on Monday, March 13th. As for WCRB in concert, on Sunday night, I'll bring you Bach's B minor Mass from Boston Baroque. It was the first of the 4 major presentations of the Mass this season, a sequence that ended last weekend with the Cantata Singers. I went to all 4 of those presentations, and you can read some of my reactions on a blog post at our website, classicalwcrb.org. And a reminder, if you went to all 4, Boston Baroque, Boston Early Music Festival, Boston Symphony, and Cantata Singers, and you posted photos on Instagram or Twitter, make sure you let me know and you'll get admission to an event later this spring on April 13th, when Boston Baroque does an open rehearsal of Julius Caesar in our Fraser Performance Studio. On the podcast this week, I've got 2 interviews that unpack some pretty big news from the Boston Symphony, along with a conversation with pianist Simona Dinnerstein, who was featured on the Bach Hour last weekend. Last week, the BSO announced some plans it's been cooking up for Tanglewood for a little while, and in the early fall, they'll break ground on a new set of buildings that include a small performance hall, 2 rehearsal spaces, and a cafe. And the major reason for the new buildings is the launch of the Tanglewood Learning Institute, which is an adult education project that's sort of analogous to one-day university and Rhodes Scholar types of programs. It's a really smart move for reasons you'll hear about soon from the 2 people I talked to about all of this. BSO Managing Director Mark Volpe and Artistic Administrator and Director of Tanglewood Tony Fogg. And Mark began our conversation by going back to the origins of this whole project.
This came out of a strategic planning process that commenced during the Great Recession when we were trying to sort out, and we kind of went into various groups, and Tony very ably staffed the Tanglewood initiative. And out of that came some thinking that we had certain challenges, albeit there are 100 buildings, you know, at Tanglewood of various sizes, and a lot of little shacks where the kids practice and get their performance chops together. But that aside, it was clear we needed space for the Tanglewood Music Center. It was clear we needed to continue partnering with Boston University for the high school program, the BUTI program, and that space is certainly a challenge there. But equally critical, if you look at the demographics, you have this wave of baby boomers starting to retire. And because of modern medicine, they're living longer, they're curious, they want to stay engaged, they want to stay intellectually active. And so we started, and Tony will talk a little bit more about the program, but we're calling it the Tanglewood Learning Institute, but it, of course, needed venues. And so we created a complex, if you will, of four pavilions, three that will have music and other activities. Tony can talk about that a little further. And then of course, food is very much part of the Tanguin experience. But right. I think, you know, if I can put a broader perspective before turning over to Tony to talk specifically about the TLI or the Tanguin Learning Institute, you know, you look at Tanguin's history, and this will be the fourth, you know, threshold moment. You know, the festival was created, you know, at the second wave of the Depression in 37 and 40, Koussevitzky had the genius and the fortitude to create a music center training the next generation of musicians, and that was 1940. And then, of course, not tied to any big geopolitical event, but we were able to acquire the Harding Estate and build Ozawa Hall and the rest of the Bernstein campus. And I think this is a fourth time where we're going to transform Tanguin and broaden Tanguin's outreach and, frankly, not just importance, but its impact, you know, in ways that only can happen at Tanguin. And at this point, I'll let Tony talk a little bit about what that TLI might how the shape it might take.
We'll do that, and we'll hear a little bit more about the structures themselves. It's always kind of fun to figure out what these things are going to look like. But yes, Tony, let's talk about the program. I think it's kind of bold to hear. I didn't even realize that the visioning for this started actually in a moment of really national crisis. And rather than sort of batten down the hatches and try to reduce, you here at the BSO, we're going to try to push forward with something new. The aspect of adult learners is a clearly big motivator behind this. But tell me what you how your thought process evolved out of those initial discussions and arrived at this point of what the Tanglewood Learning Institute is becoming.
Right, it was we were in a smaller group talking about the future of Tanglewood, the needs, and we each had to go around the table and say what we thought the single greatest need and opportunity was at Tanglewood. And my response was that we needed something in the area of adult education, because as Mark said, we do have a luckily aging population, healthier, living longer. We do have this incredibly intellectually curious body of people who come to Tanglewood for either the entire summer or for periods, who are hungry to know more about music. They're eager listeners, but they want to have more sort of insight and detailed information. And so this all came together in the idea of creating the Tanglewood Learning Institute, which would be targeted at principally at adults, that would spring from the programming of Tanglewood. It wouldn't be bringing together external or remote subject matters, certainly areas of intellectual exploration or creativity that relate to music will be part of this, but we wanted it to be about the core product that we are entrusted to support, great orchestral playing, the development of young talent, the Western musical canon and its related other languages. So we thought that's what we want to really support. And there was, frankly, there's sort of a tremendous amount of activity in these areas and in terms of discourse about music already happening, and some unbelievable minds that are assembled at Tanglewood over the course of the summer that we somehow didn't make best use of. So it's accessing what's already happening in terms of some of the activities of the Tanglewood Music Center, masterclasses and so on. It's tapping in the resources, intellectual, of people who are already there. It's giving opportunities for viewing certain activities that are happening at Tanglewood which are otherwise closed to the public. So I hope in all of this it will lead to a more informed, more satisfied set of listeners for what happens at Tanglewood.
Watching your work over the last several years and seeing some of the projects that you've had your hands on, I think of some of the multidisciplinary concert series that have happened here in Boston over the last few years, some of the talks that go on at Tanglewood. I have to think you're really excited about the prospects of programming the Tanglewood Learner Institute.
I'm excited about going to a lot of them. The trouble for me is going to be, it's going to be a complete distraction from the nuts and...
You do have a day job.
The nuts and bolts of sort of running the festival.
Yeah.
But no, I'm very, very excited about it. And it will certainly open up new possibilities in terms of types of programming that we can do. It'll certainly increase the understanding of what we're doing for, you know, the average listener in many different ways.
Yeah. So,
but to accomplish this, you need venue. You need spaces.
My next question, exactly. So the vision kind of comes, and then how do you?
The first thing you do is you sort of define what the programming is, and certainly you took what Tony described in a broad sense of what the philosophy. And the objectives of the Tanglewood Learning Institute, and then you marry those with what the Tanglewood Music Center needs, and certainly rehearsal space and other coaching space and all of that for large ensembles, mid-sized ensembles, small ensembles. So the next thing you do is you kind of define the programming, put together an RFP, request for proposals, and interview a bunch of architects. And we went and saw, I think, five different very interesting presentations, but it was readily apparent that Bill Rahn, who is the architect of record for Ozawa Hall, and certainly I don't want to suggest he had an advantage other than knowing Tanglewood so intimately that he presented a very compelling vision and that our ideas manifest itself into physical structure, and that's sort of what great architects can do. And ultimately, we start talking about, the need to break up. We have three varying sizes that can be a multi-use buildings, but one in particular, it's a very large, you can put an orchestra there, you can do opera scenes there, you can have small chamber concerts there, you can possibly have lectures, you can have lunches, you can have movies, and yet it's the transparency, which is very much part of Bill's work. It opens with lots of glass and open doors that connect the gestalt of music and nature, which Tanglewood is so well known for. He certainly has captured in the big building and the two other buildings, even the food pavilion. And so he started organizing, and then we had to site it, and just walking, spending hours walking the campus, because we have 525, 26, whatever number of acres we have. And so we had, and I had kind of a notion of where it should go, and it wasn't quite where it should go, and Bill kind of walked the crest of the hill and found this location. Situated, you have Ozawa on the back door for those of you who are able to come visit the Berkshires and Tanglewood in particular, and so you go through that back door up the lawn and at to the crest of the hill and turn left, and that's where this complex of buildings will be situated.
And this complex is oriented around a big oak tree.
Yeah, there's this wonderful tree, and the first thing you get an arborist to tell you that tree's going to live another 50 years, because you don't want to build something around a tree that has a 6-year life expectancy.
That would be bad.
No, but we do our due diligence, and then you have to build enough of a cushion around the root structure. I mean, there are people that are much more expert than we. We've retained Reed Hillebrand, one of the world's leading. Firms that deal with landscape, that will obviously augment the work that Bill Rahn's team is doing in terms of the structures. So again, because part of Tanglewood is not just these incredibly beautiful buildings that are going to have great purpose and great function, but the landscape around them is certainly part of the Tanglewood experience and how you enter, and we're also taking this opportunity. I don't think anybody anticipated how successful Ozawa Hall was going to be and the tens of thousands of people that frequent the venue for the recitals and all the other activity that Tony curates, as well as all the activity of the music center and the students. So we kind of re-looked at the gate coming in and the food service. Anybody that's been there will tell you. And that, in terms of Ozawa Hall, we've been absolutely substandard in terms of how we've organized the food, and that's now going to be addressed. And then, of course, bathrooms and pathways and wayfinding and all that. So we're really excited. This is going to once again transform Tanglewood and take it to the next level.
Yeah, and a small but significant fact about the buildings is that they will be air-conditioned. And so, of course, the main focus of the TLI and Tanglewood Music Center activities are during the summer months. The facility will be available year-round, virtually. So we hope that it'll become a great community resource. It'll be available for recording sessions, for conferences. One questions whether in the deep heart of winter it'll be used so much. But we hope that this will keep Tanglewood alive in a more tangible sense year round, and we hope that it'll be a facility that will be available for lots of education programs for young musicians and the community, and as I said, so
civic resource.
It'll be a great civic resource.
I mean, and it's obviously air conditioned as well as heated, and people don't realize in all those buildings I mentioned, it'll be the only, there's one other building that has heat where the guys who are there keeping the grounds have their offices for good reason that's heated because they're there in January and February and March. But this will be the one series of complex that'll be available year-round for use. And of course, that all has to be discussed with the various civic and community partners and the educational infrastructure of the Berkshires. And so we're not going to be presumptuous and say what's right or how it can be used. We're going to have conversations and sort it out with the appropriate people.
And the timeline is that you're breaking ground?
We're breaking ground in right after the end of the Tanglewood season in 17.
Okay.
And it's a pretty complex set of buildings because of all the purposes and all that and multi-use. So we will have it available for the launch of the 2019 Tanglewood season.
Very exciting. Well, Tony Fogg, Mark Volpe, thanks for describing it to me and thanks for letting me in on a little bit of the thinking behind it. It's really terrific stuff. Thanks a lot.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
And you can see the artist renderings of the new buildings planned for Tanglewood when you visit our website, classicalwcrb.org. About 10 years ago, pianist Simona Dinnerstein released a recording of Bach's Goldberg Variations. And it was one of those rare moments when a recording has such a personal take that you feel like you've gotten to really know the performer as well as the music. As it turns out, Simona later came to the station for a couple of performances, so we got to know her literally. And when she released a recording of Bach's Inventions and Sinfonias a few years ago, we talked about it. These pieces, which are also known as the 2- and 3-part Inventions, were written by Bach to teach young players how to handle counterpoint. And according to Simona Dinnerstein, they still serve that purpose.
I think that most piano students first experience Bach through the 2-part Inventions, and that was my case as well. I played some little preludes before I got into the Inventions, but they were certainly my first experience with counterpoint. And I very vividly remember at age 9, I was going to the Manhattan School of Music pre-college every Saturday, and they had a performance class. And I remember hearing a girl slightly older than me, playing the D minor Invention. And I just couldn't believe it. You know, I didn't understand how she could make her left hand play the way it did because I'd never heard music where the two hands were equally difficult and important. And I wanted to play it. So my first experience was really, with listening to Bach, was envy.
Well, yeah, and for, I guess, really good reasons, because you hear this music and some, if when you have that magical moment, all of a sudden, especially if you are a musician yourself, you want to grab that, you want to be a part of it. And so did it then take a while, or did you just then pull out that D minor and say, okay, well, this is my next piece?
Well, I immediately went to my teacher and asked if I could play it, and he said I wasn't ready to play that one. It has a very long trill in the right hand and a very long trill in the left hand, and I was not able to do those trills yet, let alone manipulate 2 lines. So he had me start with the C major Invention, the first one, which is the most, in a way, the most straightforward and in terms of teaching your 2 hands how to interact. And I think it was really like maybe 2 years until I was really ready to play the D minor in a way that he felt was sufficient preparation. So, yeah, I learned a lot of other variation, a lot of other Inventions in between, and I have to say that as a child, I didn't relate to all of the Inventions. Some of them I couldn't. It was so hard to play them that it was hard to get to the music because you had to just get your fingers to obey this discipline of 2 independent lines. And that's very, very hard. So now as an adult playing them again, I can see how difficult they are for children and beginners. And I find them difficult now, and I've played a lot of other music.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't want to focus too much on the academic part of these, but it is kind of fascinating that they were written kind of for the purpose you're describing, and you used them for that purpose. But what is it about counterpoint. Maybe you can even say what counterpoint is and why it's so important for a musician to understand what's going on there. Is, I mean, it must be partly physical, but also partly just sort of a mental aspect of playing that unlocks through counterpoint.
Yeah, well, counterpoint is, very broadly, counterpoint is two or more independent musical voices that interact with each other, so in an equal way. If you listen to something like a Mozart sonata, you might hear much less of that because it would be more a sense of having a melody in the right hand and a sort of harmonic accompaniment in the left hand, you know, broken chords. And in Bach's music, the way that he wrote all of his music was that each voice has an equally important role. So the first thing as a musician that you have to be able to do is to be able to hear that, which is quite difficult. It's hard to get your ear, to train your ear, to follow two independent lines and maintain interest and focus on each one. And I'm not really sure how our brains do that exactly, and it's something that I would be interested in knowing more about. And I've started reading about it, and in a way, I don't want to know about it because I don't want to become self-conscious. But on the other hand, I think that it's fascinating because I myself have had experiences, say in the recording studio, when I've been playing counterpoint, where I remember in a particular take that I was really concentrating on one voice in that take. I remember listening for only that one voice in a very particular way. And then when I listened back to the recording, the other voice was doing something very interesting and different than the voice that I was focused on consciously. So there was another part of my brain that was obviously really involved with the other voice, and I just find that amazing that our brains are able to do that.
Yeah. Well, and maybe, you know, you're going to be playing at in Worcester, part of the Music Worcester series, and on that program you'll be playing two-part inventions, but also music by Schumann and by Beethoven. So once you sort of get your brain to hear those two voices or more voices simultaneously, what does that do with the music of other composers once Bach has sort of done this to you?
Well, all piano music has multiple voices in it. Whether or not they're equal or not, you have to be hearing many different voices. And I tend to gravitate towards music where there's a level of complexity in the voicing. I'm not as interested in music that is purely melodic in one hand and purely accompaniment in the other hand. So the music that I'm playing, like even Schumann, I'm playing Kinderszenen, which is, they're short miniatures and they are very melodic, but oftentimes there are three voices, and you know, you might not hear that on the first listening, but there's an inner line that is doing something very interesting and important, and a bass line and a melodic line. And sometimes, you know, there's an interplay between the hands or between the voices that You have to really look hard at the music, and you see, oh, actually, the right hand isn't just doing one thing. The right hand's doing two different things. And I remember having a teacher in London when I was younger, Maria Curcio. She was an amazing teacher, and hearing her play some of Carnival. We were studying Carnival, and the way she showed it to me, she said, you know, you're playing it like it's just the right hand and the left hand, but actually there are four voices here. And suddenly it was like the music opened up in a completely different way. And so learning how to do that through Bach's music can be a window into other music. And, you know, if you spend a lot of time thinking about counterpoint, then you begin to see it everywhere.
Right, right. It's a key that unlocks all kinds of different things. What I also like about Kindertseinen on the program you're playing in Worcester is that this is Schumann's look back on his impressions of the experience of childhood, and here you are playing pieces that take you back to your own experience of childhood.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, when you play the inventions, and you know we're in the context here where you really came to most people's notice through the Goldberg Variations, sort of the sort of ultimate piano piece, maybe by Bach. Is there a more innocent quality to the inventions in some way musically, getting away from the whole idea of them as teaching tools? Just musically, what are they like compared to something like the Goldberg Variations, or even any of the pieces in between, like the Partitas?
Well, you know, I actually don't think that they are so innocent. I think that you can obviously view them that way. They're very pared down. And sometimes in the Goldberg Variations, there are aspects of that piece that are showy or more elaborate. You know, he's not just showing you. He's taking, in the Goldberg Variations, he's taking a chord progression, a harmonic chord progression, and elaborating on that. And there are variations on that. So it's all about the complex unfolding of a harmonic chord progression. In the inventions and the sinfonias, it's about showing the musician how different types of musical ideas can be turned into counterpoint. And so it has a kind of clarity to it, which is simple and complex at the same time. I would say that the sinfonias, to me, have a maturity in them, a sort of emotional maturity in them that matches any of the other big works, the Goldberg Variations or the partitas, or you know, even some of the cantatas. The inventions are more. There's something about them that's almost abstract. They're very emotional. They're simple and they're complex. They're unique. I think that there isn't really anything else like it, except possibly the art of fugue.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and maybe that's the very definition of music that's eternal. You can encounter it when you're 9 years old and it has a fascination, but now here you are as an adult and a professional, and it sounds like you see things in it that you know, you only came to you over time.
Yeah, and I think that that's something that great art has. It's a quality that great art has in whatever form, music, literature, painting. That music that is really rich, that is really containing a whole world and layers of complexity, can be seen in many different ways and on different levels. You can see it in a very simple way, and you can see it in a very complex way. And I think that the less great a piece of music is, the less dimensions it has.
Yeah, yeah. Another piece that you're performing in Worcester is the French Suite No. 5. And so that's a piece that, I mean, it's sort of like the Goldberg Variations or the Partitas. It's meant to have a beginning and an end in the middle, and you sort of go from one to the next, and there's a trajectory. But the inventions and the sinfonias, they're not really built that way. They're I don't think, anyway. So does that give you maybe some more freedom? Do you have more fun programming them because you can mix them up a little bit more?
Well, you know, you make a good point. I did think about mixing up the order of the inventions and not doing them in the progression that they were written in, or the key progression that they were written in. But in the end, I just kept it simple and did it in that order. I think mainly because I thought it was interesting to hear it moving from key to key the way that Bach had done. I think that even though they're not meant to be heard as a set, you usually don't sit down at a concert and hear the 15 two-part inventions played. I mean, I've never heard them performed. It's an interesting thing as a listener, I think, because you hear, it's like you're hearing many different sides of an exercise. I mean, the exercise is how do you write for two voices? And this is 15 different ways of doing that.
Right.
And each one is very different. So I think that it works as a whole because there is diversity amongst those 15 inventions.
Oh, yeah, an incredible diversity. I mean,
yeah.
It's just, it is like, I mean, in that sense, it is a lot like the Well-Tempered Clavier or the Goldberg Variations, that when you hear them all together, there's an emotional sort of thing you're on that their variety really builds in a certain experience. But when you're performing the inventions, is there something about the performance that is different from those other larger works because of this association back to your childhood and those very early memories?
That's a good question. I think I don't know if I feel that in the concerts. I think that I'm focusing so much on being in the moment.
Yeah.
I usually don't have associations like that while I'm playing.
Right.
But I do have it very much when I'm listening or when I'm practicing.
Yeah. Did the process of putting this recording together, was there anything that you found yourself looking back on and thinking, was there any particular revelation about your career as a pianist or as your life as a musician that you hadn't thought of before until you came back to really dive into these pieces?
Yes, I mean, I think that in a way, working on this was a real marker for me because I could remember studying them as a child. And in fact, I have some tapes of myself as a child performing them, which was very interesting to listen to.
Oh my gosh, you were brave enough to listen to them.
Yeah,
that takes real bravery because I think a lot of musicians would just kind of not want to go there. But.
Well, what I found interesting was that I could tell that it was me, even though I was 11 years old. I could hear myself today in that, and I think that that's interesting. It's, how do you develop an artistic personality? And, of course, many aspects of my playing have changed over the years, but I think I've always been the same musical person, and so that was kind of fascinating. And then I also went through a whole period in my 20s and my early 30s when I was teaching a lot, neighborhood kids and adults in Brooklyn, and I taught these pieces. And so I've also seen them from that angle as, what does that child need to learn? How could a certain piece of music help them with something in particular? And so I feel like I've definitely made a musical journey and a journey into maturity, both as an artist and in terms of my career. And these inventions have marked the way. I can look back at various points in my life and remember where they were in my life at that time.
Yeah. Wow. That's really fascinating. That's really neat. It's a very close relationship to these pieces then.
Yeah.
And are you do we have plans for more Bach on recording from you?
Yes, well, I plan on recording all the major keyboard works of Bach, so I think that this is going to be a lifelong project. I'm a pretty slow learner, so hopefully I'll live a long time.
That's pianist Simona Dinnerstein, who was featured on the Bach Hour last weekend. Now let's return to more news from the Boston Symphony. A week after unveiling its new plans for Tanglewood, the BSO announced details of the partnership it struck with the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra. This is an alliance built around the fact that, beginning next year, Andres Nelsons will be the music director of both orchestras, simultaneously. And I think it's a pretty creative way of taking that one fact and making a lot of interesting stuff out of it. Tony Fogg got into some of the details with me, starting with a sort of overview and how the different big ideas have become specific projects.
The elements are partly programmatic, partly to do with orchestra personnel, partly to do with some of our mutual and joint touring activities. That then translates into a number of very specific activities. We thought that one of the neat things that we could do would be to devote 1 week of BSO programming each year to the repertoire of Leipzig, which is, of course, the music of Bach, of Mendelssohn, of Schumann, the great sort of German tradition, the canon that is central to all of our musical lives, and try and explore that in ways which I think might tell us more about the musical culture of Leipzig, the social and political context in which these composers flourished, and by contrast, to do some comparisons with what was happening in Boston in the same time. So it will open a little window of understanding both about matters historical and cultural in a musical context. So that was the essential idea. Our first Leipzig week will be in the week of the 5th of February in 2018. We will be doing music by Bach, Schumann, Mendelssohn, and a new commissioned work, a joint commissioned work. But each of those composers has a particular reason, and each piece has a particular reason for being chosen. The Bach that we will be performing is the Concerto for Three Keyboards, and this is harkening back to a famous performance which took place, I think, in 1840, in which the soloists in the Bach triple were Mendelssohn, Liszt, and Ferdinand Hiller, who was one of the great virtuoso pianists of the time. And so we're trying to somehow make a 21st century parallel to that, and we have our artistic partner, Tom Addis, as one of the pianists, and two great virtuosi, Kirill Gerstein and Jean-Yves Thibaudet. So it'll be a very, very enlivening and lively performance with three grand pianos on Symphony Hall stage. We haven't had that for a while. And then a pair of lesser-known but very beautiful choral works by Robert Schumann, pieces not often played, the Abendlied and the Neujahrslied, works really at the heart of Mendelssohn's work and language, beautiful pieces, but very rarely played. Then, as I mentioned, a new work, and it's by Sean Shepard, a very talented young American composer, Brooklyn-based in his 30s. He was a Tanglewood Fellow, so we feel a special connection. And then finally, Mendelssohn's Scottish Symphony, which is a little bit more familiar fare. But I think the four works together are really an intriguing combination. And surrounding those in the course of the week, we will have panel discussions, exhibits, some chamber music, and so on. So we hope that it'll be a week in which, for that period, and then we hope following on, people will be thinking about this great repertoire and thinking about the parallels between our own creative history and that of the great city of Leipzig.
And then the next Leipzig week in Boston, I'm excited about, because it's the Christmas Oratorio by Bach. And so is that one that Andres will be conducting?
Yes, Andres will be conducting, and we're still weighing up whether we do the complete piece, all the cantatas, but my vote is for yes, but we'll have to see. But Andres, having just done his first major Bach piece with us, the B minor Mass, is very keen to continue the tradition. And so in the final subscription week before the holiday period in 2018, we'll be doing the Christmas Oratorio.
And that points to the fact that Andres is central to this whole arrangement, because he will by that time be music director of both the Gewandhaus Orchestra and the Boston Symphony. But there's also another figure who is central to both cities, and has been actually for a long time, even before this arrangement was struck, and that's Christoph Wolff. Tell me about his role in the project, what role he plays in the decision-making and the ideas that come forth.
Well, it was a funny thing, Brian, when the notion of this alliance between the two orchestras came up, we started just to brainstorm a little bit about the common elements. And there's, of course, the fact that Higginson traveled around Europe when he was thinking about forming the BSO and was really taken by the musical culture of Leipzig. In fact, about 30 players from the first BSO were trained in the Leipzig Conservatory. Of course, Symphony Hall is modeled on the second Gewandhaus. Munch was the concertmaster, so on. So we kept on going through all of these incredible coincidences. Niekisch was our conductor, as he was, Georg Henschel. So incredible parallels. And then we started to think about what else, and we realized that we had here in our community someone who was a tangible and direct link between Boston and Leipzig, and that's Christoph Wolff, a very, very distinguished scholar, but was director of the Bach Academy in Leipzig for a number of years. So we asked Christoph whether he could help us as a guide, an advisor, a consultant, about many aspects of an alliance, just helping us fill in the elements of our knowledge about the musical life of Leipzig that perhaps wouldn't be familiar, talking in a very specific way about the parallels between the two cities, both economic and musical, and then some real nuts and bolts about areas of discussion, of discourse, for exploration through exhibits that could be of interest to the Boston community that he knows so well. And likewise, when it's come to the Boston Weeks in Leipzig, he's given some very, very interesting advice about what subjects about Boston Symphony and Boston's musical life and culture may be of interest to the good folk of Leipzig. So he's been a really fantastic link, and a man of such distinguished pedigree and thought that it's been a great honor to get to know him and work with him more closely.
Well, and anyone who meets him knows what a warm person he is, and how great he is just to work with in general. Part of the arrangement with the Gewandhaus Orchestra includes some musician exchanges, which is a really fascinating concept. I want to ask you, I don't know if the specifics of that are really worked out too much. I know that the first Gewandhaus week, or the first Leipzig week in Boston, I should say, includes some of the Gewandhaus players doing the Mendelssohn Octet with players from the BSO. Is there more about musician exchanges that has been worked out so far?
We're working on the detail of this pretty intensively at the moment. You mentioned the visit by the Gewandhaus Quartet, and that's, a fairly straightforward arrangement where they'll come and join with members of the Boston Symphony Chamber Players to perform a chamber music concert, and reciprocally the chamber players will be traveling to Leipzig in late June of 2018 for a Boston Week in Leipzig. But the notion of an exchange is not an entirely new one. Back in the late 70s, early 80s, we had an exchange with musicians of the New Japan Philharmonic Orchestra. So there is some precedent for this. We're looking at how this might be structured in the future, whether it's 3 months or 6 months exchange. Thinking about practical matters like which instruments would be suitable to be transposed from one orchestra to another. Once you get into certain wind instruments, clarinets and oboes and so on, there's a matter of the type of instruments that are played, the pitch in which they play. So there are some purely practical considerations to sort through. Then we look at how we can welcome a musician into our musical family, provide the housing, all of those sorts of things. So, but it's very much an idea that has great enthusiasm on the part of both our players and those of the Gewandhaus Orchestra.
Well, it brings to mind what the personality of the Gewandhaus Orchestra is. And I don't know if there's a way that you can, you know, concisely wrap this up, but what is the... How would you compare the Gewandhaus Orchestra and the BSO, both two of the world's great orchestras, but they're not the same kind of orchestra? What do you hear from the Gewandhaus Orchestra in comparison to the BSO?
In particular, I mentioned oboes and clarinets earlier. There's something about the style of wind playing of the Gewandhaus Orchestra, which is very, very distinctive. Perhaps a little, how do I say, there's more chiff in the sound. There's more... slight edge to the woodwind sound compared to, say, the BSO, which is incredibly polished and velvety. I think the approach to string playing is also slightly different. If you look at the way the bass section plays, they hold the bows in a different way, which of course influences the color of the tone that they produce. So there are sort of a lot of technical things about them which lead to this different character. When the Gewandhaus was here a couple of years ago and they did a Mendelssohn program with Ricardo Chailly, fantastic concert with the original version of the Reformation Symphony and a couple of other works. It was just the sheer authority in that style that you sort of were struck by. And it's a bit hard to put in words what exactly that means, but there was something you knew that you were going back to the sources. Just as when you hear the BSO several generations later playing, for instance, the Bartok Concerto for Orchestra or the Symphony of Psalms, or many French works, of which we were sort of the immediate inheritors, you can hear there's just something so absolutely right about the way they play that repertoire. So it's one of those magical and slightly indefinable things about music and orchestral playing.
And we'll have a chance to hear the Gewandhaus Orchestra here in Boston at some point during this alliance as well, I would imagine, during their touring.
Yeah, we're hoping to host them for a residency in which they will perform on their own and combine with the BSO. And we're thinking very hard about what colossal piece might call for two orchestras. And certainly there are some works from the 19th and 20th century for very large orchestra. But there was also, during the early 19th century, there was a tradition of playing classical works with a huge orchestra. So it might be fun to turn back the clock historically and try and recreate one of those types of concerts, or at least a half of a program, and give everyone the chance to experience what it must have been like to attend a concert and a performance in Leipzig in the early part of the 19th century.
You might need to use Christian Science Plaza or something to do it.
I can see those jumbotrons being plugged in already.
Tony Fogg, thanks for your time.
My pleasure, Brian.
You can read more about the BSO Gewandhaus Alliance when you visit our website, classicalwcrb.org. And again, that's also where you'll find more about the new buildings at Tanglewood. You can subscribe to The Answered Question at iTunes or through your favorite podcast app. And you'll also find TAQ on WCRB's Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud pages. Thank you to the guests on this podcast, including Mark Volpe, Tony Fogg, and Simona Dinnerstein. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.